on insured.org.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 12 days from now, mark it on your calendar, February 27th. That's when the judges at the Grammy Awards will announce whether what you're listening to is the jazz instrumental album of the year. The album is called Kindred. The pianist is Jackie Terrison. The man playing the vibes is Stefan Harris. He's 28 years old, and the godfather of jazz criticism, Gary Giddens of The Village Voice, calls him the most imposing vibes player to come along in many years, a man who reigns over his instrument with casual authority. Connection listeners, the vibraphone is one of the anchors of jazz. It's the voice of Lionel Hampton and Milt Jackson. It is a melody-producing weapon of percussive force. Now, what in your mind is the place of the vibraphone in jazz? What do you hear that's special in the vibes of Stefan Harris? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And the song we're listening to is George Gershwin's Summertime. The man who plays those vibes is with me in the studio, listening along with us. That was quite a remarkable little partnership you and Jackie had in the recording of Kindred.
Yeah, it was. We had a really good time making that record. It was very spontaneous. Most of the songs are first takes. We had 2 days in the studio, but pretty much we recorded that record in the first day.
And is that when it's the most fun as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. When you really don't judge the music, you just play and you say, well, okay, that's what happened. Let's go on to the next song. You know, it's very relaxed and it keeps it spontaneous.
Let's look at who else is on the list for 12 days from now. Sonny Rollins, Pat Martino, Dave Holland, and Stefan Harris. That's pretty interesting company.
Yeah. I just say, hey, it's an honor to be nominated, and I'm glad that people are appreciating the work that we're putting out here. I'd be happy to lose to any of those guys.
You play a lot of instruments, don't you?
Well, you know, when I started out, I'm from Albany, New York, and I was a very unfocused kid. You know, I just wanted to try everything. So I taught myself to play the piano and to read music at a very young age. So when I went to elementary school in fourth grade to start giving lessons, I could already read, so I was a lot more advanced than the other students. So just to keep me busy, the teachers would say, well, okay, try the clarinet. And I'd take that home, and I'd get through the book, and they say, okay, well, take the trombone home, and how about the bass? So by the time I was in eighth grade, I played all the band instruments.
And how did you end up playing with a vibraphone?
Wow, it was a very random decision. You know, like, I like the vibraphone. It's a cool instrument, but my true passion is for the music itself, not really the instruments. So what happened was my middle school teacher said to me, you know, you can't play all these instruments. You're going to be the jack of all trades and master of none. So he said, you have to pick something. So I was watching television one Christmas Eve, and there was an orchestra on television called the Empire State Youth Orchestra. And I said, wow, I want to be on TV. You know, I'm in eighth grade at the time. I want to be a part of that. Give me a tuxedo. And, you know. So I flipped through the phone book and found the name of the organization in the phone book and called them up and said, you know, I play a couple instruments and I want to audition. So they let me take an audition. I auditioned on clarinet and I auditioned on percussion because those were my two strongest instruments at the time. I ended up getting alternate on clarinet, and I was accepted as a percussionist. And this is just in that family, so it was a real random decision like that.
Now, when you're accepted as a percussionist with an organization like that, are they accepting you to play the vibraphone or the marimba, to play the drums? How big's the category?
Well, as an orchestral percussionist, you have to know all of these instruments: the marimba, the vibraphone, the timpani, snare drum, orchestral cymbals and triangles, and you know, sitting in the back of the orchestra, you have to know how to count too, because you do a lot of waiting.
You do some teaching too, don't you?
Yes, I love to teach.
Can you do a little teaching for us here? Can you parse out the vibraphone from the marimba and everything else that a symphony percussionist would have to play?
Oh, okay. Well, the vibraphone is actually one of the only instruments made in America. You know, the saxophone is German and all these other instruments. It's like the vibraphone and the banjo and the harmonica or something are the only instruments made here. Its ancestor is the balafone, which is a really beautiful instrument. It's very small at times, and it's just these long strips of wood with gourds under each of the pieces of wood to help the sound resonate. Then you have the...
I've seen those for sale, I'm sure. I used to do some traveling in Africa, places like Zambia. They'd be selling these things at the side of the road. Is that the...
Yeah. And it was actually used to tell stories. It was they created a language which people could understand, and they would...
Does that now go on into the history of the vibraphone as well? I mean, is it also a storytelling instrument?
Well, certainly, I think as an improviser, I'm always focused on trying to be clear and having a story in what I'm doing. I'm not sure that that you can translate it into words directly so that you understand it in that sense, but there's definitely a sense of contour and storytelling when we're improvising. So basically, they extended the gourds and made them into these long tubes which you see hanging in front of xylophones and vibraphones and marimbas.
For the people who will be listening to our conversation, I wonder if I can get you to illustrate with the mallets a little bit about what the scope of the instrument is. I mean, it looks physically like a grown-up xylophone and two keyboards, but there's a lot more to it than that.
I like that one, a grown-up xylophone. So the marimba and the xylophone, those are made of wood. So they don't. When you strike wood, it resonates very briefly. It's a very short sound. Whereas the vibraphone is made of metal. So if you don't have anything touching it and you strike a note, it'll ring long like this. And then under all of the bars, there's a piece of felt, which if I let my foot off the pedal, the felt actually muffles the bars, and that stops them from ringing like this. I step on the pedal. So you have this sustained effect, more like a human voice. And then the other added feature of the vibraphone, where I think it gets part of its name, is inside of each of the tubes, there's a little metal disc at the top. And if I close this disc so that it's flat over the opening of the tube, the sound is a little muffled like this. And if I open it halfway, you'll hear the instrument gets a little louder.
That's the vibration.
Right.
You're actually creating, right?
Right. And then there's a little piece of a belt which spins around. So it has a switch. You can turn it on, and that disc will start spinning around, and it'll create a vibrato like this. And you can vary the speed. You can make it faster. I didn't scare you, did I?
No. I'm just thinking how much I want to get up out of my chair and come over to the other side of the studio and play. I mean, play with a small P, not a capital P.
Right.
It's fun to play.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really love it. I love the visual side of this instrument also. When I'm improvising, I'm often thinking in gestures. I think in dance motions. You know, I have a lot of like... fluttering sounds like I'm skipping a rock across water. And it's interesting because you can see the motion physically. You know, you see a person's upper body when they're standing in front of this instrument, and you see the hands moving, and we're dancing, as opposed to someone who may have to play a tuba and has to sit a certain way. You know, so I really appreciate that element about it. And also spiritually, physically, I feel so free standing in front of this instrument.
Just standing. That's got to have something to do with it, right? The fact that you get to move while you're playing it.
Yeah, and I can dance when I'm playing. You know, like I don't have to have my foot on the pedal. Most of the time I do, but, you know, I can get a little two-step going and just let the rhythm flow all the way through me. So
now there's a lot more to the instrument than the keyboard, if we can call it that, because so much of it has to do with the mallet and the way that you manipulate the mallets that are hitting the bars. Is that right? Bars, is that the right...
Yeah.
Name for them? Yeah.
Bars. Yeah, and there are different types of mallets. Some are harder, some are softer, and that's something that helps delineate different styles. For example, Lionel Hampton played with a much harder mallet. Like, let me grab one as an example. So these mallets here will have a much harder sound. So he would play with that, and then he also had the motor going very quickly like this. And then Milt Jackson came along, and I think that his goal was more, he wanted to make the instrument sing a little bit more like a human voice. So he actually slowed the vibrato down more like a singer would do, and he used softer mallets like these. I have a bag full of mallets over here. You can't see them.
And the ones that Stefan has just taken out are fatter, actually.
The head of the mallet is much larger. Milt Jackson was the first person to try playing with mallets like these. So he slowed the vibrato down and used softer mallets, and it would sound more like this. So it's a very different personality, using different mallets and different speeds for the discs which are spinning around.
And when you decide what voice you want to give the vibraphone, are you somewhere between? Are you still figuring out what Stefan Harris's voice is on the vibraphone? How do you make that decision?
I'm very eclectic. I use all of it. Sometimes it's very slow, and then sometimes let me grab some more mallets here. Sometimes I use really hard mallets, sometimes I use really soft, and there are times when I'll speed the motor up all the way like this, and I'll actually slow it down or speed it up.
Actually, while you're playing.
While
you can
I'm
mess
playing.
With that, yeah?
Yeah, so I do that. Sometimes I'll take one stick and turn it around backwards so I'm striking with my left hand with the normal side of the mallet, and with my right hand I'll double with the back side of the stick an octave higher to create an effect like this. So I'm using all
space.
Types of sound. Yes,
the final
space.
Frontier.
Sometimes I tap on the resonators themselves. Which is more of like a balafon effect because they have a little buzzing. And a lot of the Mexican traditional music, their marimbas actually buzz. So, I have so many influences, and you know what? If I'm not discovering something new every night, if I'm not trying something, I feel like I'm not really playing. So, there's some nights where I might kick the instrument, you know what I mean? I'm always looking for something, so I guess I haven't found my sound, and I hope I never do. I want to always be looking for
it. It's a great matchup for what? For a piano? For a stand-up bass? What's your ideal combination here? Where do you think the vibraphone is best showcased in a jazz club?
Well, I mean, I think it can fit in anywhere. It's just
a
matter of the practitioner.
It's such a commanding presence, right? I can see you sort of having to restrain yourself a little bit.
Well, no, actually, I look at it very differently. I think that this instrument is very beautiful. It has an effect of almost lurking in the background at times. Like, I really love performing with vocalists. There's something about the sound, like when you're comping along with them, if you just pick, you know, let me grab some more mallets.
Okay.
What do I have here? Sometimes people will play with four to create a chord. So sometimes people will comp on the vibraphone, and it sounds kind of like the way a pianist would comp. And I don't like to comp like that. I think that's approaching the instrument like a piano. I take more of an approach of just like piecing one and two notes together like a ghost in the background. So if there's a song that's dancing along at a fast tempo, I might just play.
Connection listeners, my guest is Stefan Harris. And our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you would like to speak with one of the top vibraphonists playing, performing, and composing in the country, that's the number, 1-800-423-8255. A little more music from Stefan Harris. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR.
And the islands.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. You're listening to Stefan Harris on the vibraphone. I feel almost like I shouldn't be talking while you're playing. So I'll get someone else to sing alongside with me. We've got Gary Giddens on the phone. He is the jazz critic for the Village Voice and considered by many to be the jazz critic in the United States. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I've asked you on the program because Stefan Harris is too humble to tell me just how well he's doing in the profession right now, and I need someone like you to kind of fill that in for us.
Oh, well, he's one of the exciting young musicians who's come along in the last decade or so and gives us all hope that the music has an exciting future because he Well, for one thing, he swings. He has tremendous energy and a great vigor about his playing. He sounds older than he is. He sounds like somebody who's really, you know, absorbed the music in such a profound way that you always feel very comfortable when you listen to him because he's completely in control of what he does. And he's a surprising musician. And he's given the Vibes a whole new life at a time when... When you talk about that particular instrument, you're usually talking about musicians who are, you know, at the very least in their 50s and 60s. And he's just one of those players that whose career you watch with great anticipation and great pleasure.
And when Stefan is on stage performing, give us a little bit of a visual of what that's like, because he was talking a bit about it earlier as well, Gary.
Well, I've actually learned quite a bit from listening to him, and not surprisingly. But he really dominates the whole instrument. One of the things I find very exciting about his solos is the way he really uses the entire keyboard. By doing that, he gets some very interesting harmonies going along while he's constructing a relatively linear solo, and the very linearity of his solos takes him again up and down the keyboard. So there are just kinds of parabolas of melody that are very distinctive, very much his, and he seems to always to be having a good time up there, which is really important. I mean, jazz went through a period when everybody looked like undertakers on the stage, and it could it really brought audiences. It made you feel like it was homework or some terribly somber occasion. And a lot of the really gifted young musicians who have come along in this past decade, many of them associated with Stefan, don't have those pretensions. They're out to play music that they love and that the audience loves, and so there's a great deal of kind of musical magnetism that comes from the stage when they're up there.
Has he got it right, Stefan?
Oh, of course. So, Gary, man,
which
what
part
do I...
do you want to disagree with so far?
Gary, do I owe you $6,000 or $7,000 for that? I don't know. No, I mean,
it's funny. I had a feeling from listening to his recordings and going to hear him a couple of times that I really could pick out his sound at any time. It's very distinctive in his play, kind of blindfold testing. List jazz fans always pride themselves, with tenor saxophones, there's 40 or 50 guys that you could recognize after 8 bars. I doubt if there's half a dozen Vibes players. But several months ago, a friend of mine came over with another record that Stefan was on last year called the Classical Jazz Quartet, playing Tchaikovsky. And he blindfolded me, and he just picked that one track. I don't even remember which one it was. And after listening to 2 or 3 minutes, I said, one thing I know for sure is it's not Stefan Harris. And I think it's because maybe the context had me so thinking in terms of Milt Jackson and the Modern Jazz Quartet. What he said, what Stefan said earlier about, I don't think I really have my sound yet, there's a certain amount of modesty there, but I also think that he draws on so many different on so much of the past and on so much of the present. He has such a tremendous harmonic sophistication that he's definitely not a closed book. I mean, I imagine his style is going to be evolving in all sorts of ways over the long stretch of his career.
Gary, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Gary Giddens is jazz critic at the Village Voice, and as I mentioned earlier in the program, Stefan Harris is my guest in the studio. He is standing at his vibraphone as we speak. We talk about your drawing on different musical inspirations, Jackson and Hampton, but you do a lot of reading as well. You're not restricted to just looking for musical inspiration here, are you?
Oh, absolutely not. Music is very secondary in my life, actually. Music is, I look at it, it's just a reflection of a person's inner spirit. So I'm more concerned about my spirit than I am my technical ability at an instrument or seeking to find an individual voice. That's not really a goal of mine. I mean, it's just, I just want to play. And I think that we're all individuals, we're all unique naturally, so you don't really have to try to do that, so you don't have to force it. If you're patient, all of that is going to come out naturally. Like Gary mentioned, I have a lot of different influences, which is great, and I hope that they come through. If they don't, that's fine also. But I think that some of them come through, and that's great for me. I'm happy about that. I just know that I'm young. I haven't been playing jazz that long, and I'm happy that I've come a long way in a short period of time, and what's in my head, I'm nowhere near it. So I know I have so much further to go, But the thing that makes me the most happy is that I can actually hear it. I know where it is. It's just going to take me a lifetime to get there.
One of the things that always gets me about percussionists that I've met is that they're always sort of at work. If there's utter silence in the room, there's fingers yeah. moving, right? And if there's music going, there's something else move. Or you know, there's a beat, it seems, in a lot of places that many of us aren't hearing it. Are you tuned to that? Is this something that's important to you?
Oh, definitely. One of the ways that I practice, actually, I don't practice at my instrument that much. I find that my weaknesses fall more in the category of musical issues, not technical issues. So I don't practice the vibraphone that much. One of the things that I do to practice is I'll go to crowded spaces and I'll sit and I just listen to all of the sounds around me, and I'll see how many of those different sounds I can keep track of at any one moment.
You mean like a conversation or a passing car?
Yeah, you know, like a piece of paper sliding across the table. I'm conscious of all of that, you know, and not only from the sound, but also visual. Like, you know, I just noticed that your pen moved an inch. I noticed that you nod. You know, I hear the sound of your voice, and I hear the rhythm of the way you speak, which is very different. And I try to absorb everything that's going on at any given moment.
How do you use it, though? I mean, it'd be almost like overload for me.
Well, it translates very beautifully to jazz, actually, because when you're on the bandstand, even when you're not playing, you're a part of the music. I mean, the music is alive and it's breathing, and you have to really, like, if you're playing, you have to be able to make sure that what you're playing is coming from the ensemble. You can't just stand up and just create something on the spot. At least that's not my take on it. I don't look at this as a creative process. It's a process of discovery, which is very different. A creative process means I'm going to take A and B, I'm going to put them on top of each other and create this thing. That's not what I'm trying to do. My goal is to let whatever is there come through me. So I really have to learn how to listen and be aware of everything that's going on around me. I have to be able to react to one cymbal note in the context of 12 piano notes. But I have to hear that cymbal note. Even if I decide not to react to it, that has to be a conscious decision for me that, okay, I don't need to deal with that. Or I'm not hearing anything related to it. So practicing listening is an essential part of jazz, in my opinion. I mean, it's really a very spontaneous music. You never really know what's going to happen. And if you're going to stay spontaneous and remain a part of the community, because you really are a community when you're on stage, whether it's four people, two, or 12, you're sharing ideas. There's no leadership, per se, where I'm directing everything. It's not like that at all. When my ensemble, we come on stage, we don't have a set list. We just start playing. Maybe I'll pick the first song, maybe. We start playing, and sometimes we play the entire set without a break. Sometimes we play one song and stop. It's really a matter of when the music wants to stop. So the significance of listening is very great.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold's joining us. Hi, Harold.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
It's a good show. And welcome to Boston, Stephen.
Oh, thank you.
Are you going to do any club dates, or is it just going to be the Berklee and that kind of stuff in the future?
I'm sure we'll appear at some clubs at some point. Right now, for tonight, we're going to be at the Berklee Performance Center.
Well, I'm an old practicing listener, to quote you, because it was Bud Powell that touched me in 1951 when I saw him in Boston. And needless to say, I've been listening to a lot of music and going to a lot of live music over the years. Remember the name Teddy Charles?
No, tell me about him.
Well, if you're a vibe player, you better go find some old Prestige re-releases, because he recorded with Charles Mingus.
What's the name again?
Teddy Charles.
Okay.
You better hip to yourself to that, because
he's
part of the legacy, you know?
Right.
And the last time I saw Beggs, rest his spirit, he says, you know, we're just basically a bebop band, but we can play anything. And that's what he said. And I'm glad to hear that you are on a spiritual journey, because that's where it's really at.
Well, thank you.
And no insider trading with Gary Giddens. I dig that.
Harold, thanks a lot for calling.
Love you madly.
You have fans. You have fans you may not even heard of.
Yeah, I appreciate those kind of phone calls because, again, I'm young in the music. There's a lot of stuff that I haven't heard.
Well, that's one of the cool things about jazz is that as soon as you think you may know something about it, and I'm sitting evidence of this, there's a whole lot more to learn.
Right.
This is Feline Blues. This is Stefan Harris from his album Black Action Figure. And I hear when I listen to a recording, what you're saying when you talk about sinking yourself in with the other musicians,
right?
You know, rather than, okay, it's my turn, my solo, back on.
Right. Like right now, this is Steve Turay playing trombone. I'm actually playing, but I'm inside of the drum set. This instrument can function in a lot of different ways. It's very harmonic, but it can also be very rhythmic. So I'm just playing inside the sound of the tom-toms and the cymbals. Right. Well, actually, in that moment that we brought it back, I guess I wasn't playing. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It's very spontaneous.
Do you like listening to the recordings of that you have done, or do you tend to do them and say, that was fun, move on, what's next? How do you react to the body of work that you've got? Because as Gary was saying, you're on symphonic recordings, you're working all the time.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I guess, honestly, you know, I'm not being funny, but I actually like the records that I've done. Again, and because I don't really take credit for them as a creator, it's like it just came through me. Like the music already existed, so I can actually listen to it as an outsider, even though I may have written the music and I may have played the notes. When I hear it totally objectively.
And do you hear, this goes back to what you were saying about listening, do you hear something in the mix when you get a chance to sort of put your feet up and listen to it, which you may not have been listening to at the time, or does it actually take you back to the moment?
Oh, it does. It does both. It definitely takes me back to the moment, and that's one of the beautiful things about music. It actually captures. It can capture smells. Sometimes I hear music from when I was, you know, 6, 7 years old, and it reminds me of the smell of the kitchen at that time. If I was listening, I love music. It's so fantastic. So yeah, it brings me back to a certain moment when I'm recording, but also as I listen, I learn new things about the music as I'm listening to even things that I've written. I discover more about the big picture of who I am and where I might be going. You know, all that stuff is hidden in there. There's a lot of lessons in there.
Stefan Harris is my guest. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Boston. Susan's joining us. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I've got to say I'm a brand new fan of Stefan Harris's. I hadn't heard the name up before this week, I'm ashamed to say, but I am a brand new fan, and I wholeheartedly agree with what he has said up to now about the vibraphone. I think it speaks to the culture of the people, to the spirit and soul of the people, and it works in pretty much any kind of music that I've heard it played in. And I think it just is represented in so many different countries around the world, including Indonesia with the gamelan and the marimbas, as he was talking about, and just all the other percussive instruments that, you know, are similar to the vibes.
When I was doing some homework last night, Susan, I was reading some of what Stefan had said and written earlier about culture specifically, that you know, there are times when he takes the notion of the calabash gourd and you know, it's an important part, but other times when, Stefan, you kind of want the culture thing to be a whole lot bigger than that, not a straight line from, you know, where the origins of the instrument to your role as an African-American musician playing in America today, but bigger than that, right?
Absolutely. That's one that I'm grappling with, the whole importance of culture in terms of being locked into a culture that you may have grown up in.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I'm a citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a human being first, and all these notions of race and things like that, those are things that are created by mankind and that we've accepted, but it's not necessarily what's most natural. I think the things that are natural are the things that are inside of us. And when I hear something and I'm attracted to it, that's a part of me. If I study it and it comes into my being and it feels very comfortable to me, then that's a part of my culture. If it came from Asia, if it came from India, that's totally irrelevant to me. totally irrelevant. Now, naturally, I mean, I'm more influenced by African-American culture because I've spent most of my life engulfed in that culture. But I've certainly read a lot of books and things outside of that culture and that I really feel are a part of my music and a part of who I am.
I mean, you titled one of your discs Black Action Figure. This is the one that has you leaping across the cover of the disc. Is that just a play on you being this sort of physical creature performing the music?
Yeah, it's just a play on words, and it's, you know, it can be interpreted in a lot of ways. It's just a fun title. I wouldn't read too deeply into that one.
I wonder, though, Susan, when you start listing off all the connections that you can make among different percussion instruments that come from all over the world, that if that isn't kind of part of what allows Stefan to talk about Citizen of the World, because if there's anything all cultures share, it is, you know, it's the drum, it's the percussion.
I completely agree. I think it so defines, and to me, the spirit of a culture, you know, just kind of by their, I don't know, I guess I've never really thought of it in such words, but their percussive music, I think it just clearly speaks to what the culture is about.
Thanks for your call.
You know, another interesting thing about rhythm that I find really fascinating is language, how each rhythmic style from a different region of the world is very reflective of the language that's spoken there. When you listen to where Spanish is spoken, and the rhythms are very light, very mm-hmm. syncopated, off the beat. Then you'll listen to music from Ghana, and it's very heavy. You use larger drums, and it's more bass-driven, more on the beat. And that's very reflective of the sound of the voice and the language that's spoken there.
This is Fly Like an Eagle. Connection listeners, my guest is Stefan Harris. We're talking about the vibraphone, but we're actually talking about a whole lot more than that. We're inviting you into the conversation. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is Stefan Harris. We're listening to one of his own compositions. This is Song of the Whispering Banshee. Grand Unification Theory. It's a long piece you're working on, concert-length piece. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I'm finished with it now. I was commissioned by an organization, the Troy City Savings Bank Music Hall. That's a mouthful there.
So it's Grand Unification Theory.
Right. Actually, I was commissioned to write a 15-minute piece. When I picked up the pencil, I just started writing, and when I was finished, it ended up being a full-length concert piece. So it's 11 movements for a 12-piece ensemble.
What about the composing? Do you like that side of it?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I mean, to me, that's like the clearest reflection of your inner spirit, because it's slow and it's patient and you don't have to force anything. Sometimes when you're in a performance, there's the element of time, you know, and the tempo is ticking and the song is only a certain length. So, you know, it's like tell your story within this period of time. So it's a little bit more difficult to do in terms of improvising, but composing is... You know, I'll be working on a piece for a year, and I don't rush it at all. Until it comes out honestly and freely, I don't worry about it. So I think it's a truer representation, actually.
Once it's done, though, does that take away from some of the opportunity to play, some of the opportunity to, you know, just let the moment rule what it is that you want to do, because then it's down on paper. It's like you got to read those words, no?
Oh, no. Well, we can come and hear us on one night and come hear us the next night, and we'll play the song completely differently. Sometimes we'll play a ballad really fast with a backbeat. It's totally different. It's just spontaneous. It's like I used to joke that, you know, wow, my compositions, they're like children, man. You know, you have these kids and you can't tell them who they're going to be as human beings. They take on a life of their own. You write a piece of music, it's written down, and you just place it in different environments. Environments meaning different groups of musicians. And in jazz, the music is so open, and it allows for individuals to contribute their special or whatever it is that's unique about them. So depending on who's playing the music takes on a different character.
And when you conceived of the title, Unification Theory, great grand, what is it? Great
The Grand Unification Theory.
The Grand Unification Theory. That's physics. This is...
Yeah, it's a theory in physics and quantum physics. I'm very eclectic, again, my reading and what I'm interested in. Anything that sparks my interest, I'll just grab. Like, you look in my stick bag right now. I have a book with me. This is a great book. I'm glad that this is an NPR show. I love this book. I bought it for my nephew. It's called The Number Devil, and it's a mathematical adventure by Hans Magnus Eisenberger. And it's just like this story of this kid who has these nightmares, and then there's this little devil that comes along and stops his nightmares and starts teaching him about math. So it's like all the basic concepts of mathematics, but it's taught in a story.
Did you ever read Sophie's Theory, the translated book from, I think it's from Sweden? It's the same sort of thing about a little girl who keeps getting these messages about the different philosophers, you know?
Right, right.
The dog delivers them, and she's reading about Plato, and it's the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a great way for kids to learn. And this is a book, I think that's for children, but it's very entertaining for me. So there, I'm studying like the basics of mathematics,
and this is going to show up in your playing, in your composition as well.
Oh, maybe, I don't know. But to answer your question, the Grand Unification Theory, it's a theory in quantum physics, and at the time, I was reading a lot of different stuff. I was writing poetry, and my time was very divided. I mean, music was a part of my life, but it actually wasn't occupying the majority of my time, and I started to worry about that. And when I got this commission to write this larger work, I said, okay, great, it'll be a chance for me to focus more on music. But I didn't really want to. It wasn't like I want to spend all my time just playing music. So I was reading this book, A Brief History of Time. It's Stephen Hawking's book,
yeah.
Right, and I came across his writings about the Grand Unification Theory, which is this notion of there are four basic major forces in the universe. There's like gravitational, electromagnetic energy, and then there's like weak nuclear and strong nuclear. And the theory basically says, oh, I hope I'm summing this up correctly, basically says that all of these different forces are not different. They're actually the same force acting at different energy levels. And he gives a great analogy of the roulette ball spinning around the table, how if it's spinning at a low energy level, you see red and black. And you see a ball spinning in a slot. Then as the energy increases, the ball becomes a solid line. To your perception, if you walk in, you say, oh, there's a solid line on it. But it's actually the same thing acting at a different energy level. So I took something like that, and I applied that to my life in terms of all the things that I was studying. It's like, wow, maybe they aren't different. Maybe they're all related.
And maybe they're supposed to be related.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then I found a way to take all of the things that I was interested in and express them through the idiom of music. And that's what this piece, The Grand Unification Theory, is.
We'll get a chance to listen to a little bit more of it later on. We've got some people on the line who still want to talk to you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Ed's joining us now from Concord. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, listen, I'm in a band right now, and we have a vibe player in our band. He's actually been taking lessons from you. I won't say his name, but in the last couple of weeks.
How's he doing? Is he better?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, it's great. And to tell you the truth, the reason why I called was because it's sort of a pseudo-rock band and with jazz overtones. And it's too bad that the vibe seem to have a history of, I don't want to say like a Lawrence Welkism, you know, as far as don't get me wrong, as far as the general population goes, and people are in tune to jazz and that kind of stuff. And And it's nice to have people like yourself who come on out.
We're doing a little Lawrence Welk here for you, Ed.
No bubble machines in the background, please. You know, but it's nice to see guys like you. I mean, you remind me sort of like a Harry Connick Jr. who come out at your age group who can sort of bring it down to more of to get more and more people educated as to the intricacies and the sort of quilt-like web that you can make with the instrument. And I come from a history of heavy rock, you know, rock and blues. And it's great having a vibe player in the band to sort of lend that whole new twist to things. And every time we play out, people just love it. A lot of the kids, and we're talking age group, like people like in their 20s, early 20s, who aren't into jazz at all. But they think, wow, this is a hip instrument, you know.
Yeah.
And luckily, you know, you have to have a certain amount of technique, because you know you don't want it to sound like a doorbell solo
right.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. No, it is a very hip instrument. It's visually a lot of fun, but again, I don't know who the person is who's taking lessons with me, but I'm sure that I told the person in the lesson that it's not really about the instrument, it's really about the person playing the instrument. The instrument is cool, it's fun, but if you have somebody who's not bringing something strong to it, it doesn't come across strong. If you have someone who's confident in who they are and are very clear about their intentions in terms of what they want to express, and the technique, that's basic mathematics. The science part of it is basic mathematics. Once you get past that, that's when it really gets interesting.
Can you give us something that's really interesting?
I don't know. Let's see. I won't play a song. One of the things that I do, I think in terms of shapes. So let's see what I can do with that. Let's see.
You could see what I'm seeing. It is a performance to watch. Ed, thanks a lot for your call. And we're going to Natick, Massachusetts. Chris is joining us. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hi. You're an incredible musician. I really enjoy listening to you.
Thank you.
At the top of the hour, in the introduction, there was a comment made about something about you don't like to use terms like flat nine, chord types. Is this a fair characterization of your point of view? I mean,
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Especially my basic philosophy about what I'm doing is I'm performing and communicating something to non-musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So a flat nine, what does that mean to someone who's not a musician? That has no emotional content. So, and it also has no context. For example, a flat nine over a dominant chord might sound like this. But over a major chord, it has a totally different personality. It's a very bizarre sort of sound. So I tend not to talk in those terms. I understand theory in that sense, but I think it's better to talk emotionally about the sounds and give them personality. It really helps people understand the music a little bit better.
And with your students, do you communicate with them in a different way from the way you communicate with lay people? Is this a different...
No, I try to instill the same thing in my students. And, you know, another thing I mentioned earlier about my fascination with language from different regions of the world. When I'm playing, I literally talk. I take sentences. I'm saying, how are you doing today? Da, 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 da. And I'm taking those sentences and I'm taking the words away. So da, 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 boo-doo, da, do, da, do, 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 de, do, de, do, de, do, da, ah, way, da, do, de, da, da, do, ooh, ee, ooh, ee, ooh, ooh, do, de, ah, ooh, ee, do, 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 de, do, 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 I might say, ha, ha, do, do, e, ooh, do, ah, ooh, 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 ee, ah, boo, do, be, oh, boo, do, boo, do, ah, ee, oh, ah, ah, do, ooh, ee, silly, oh, see, da, do, do, de, da, da, ha. So, like, really always bringing music back to a human side. Like, what does that have to do with flat nine? None of that's totally irrelevant. what's relevant is that a person who's not a musician will understand what I just played because I'm speaking the same language as them.
We're lucky we're in Boston. That was a grad course in vibraphone. We talked a little bit earlier. Chris, thanks for your call. We talked a little earlier, Stefan, about Milt Jackson and his inspiration. You actually saw him play on the streets in New York City when you were young?
Well, no, I'm from upstate New York, but when I first moved to New York City, I think it may have been my first day in New York City. I got to my apartment,
right.
And a friend of mine was walking down the street, and, you know, he was like, yo, Milt Jackson's playing around the corner. I was living around the corner from Grant's Tomb, and they have Jazzmobile does these concerts there. And I was like, get out of here. So I walk around the corner, my first day in New York, and there's Milt Jackson. I had a chance to meet him. And, I mean, I talked to him several times since then, and we got to know each other a little bit, and he's a very big influence on me. So, I mean, it was I miss him. And one day I was sitting at the piano when I was working on Grand Unification Theory, and I was waiting. When I'm composing, I do a lot of waiting, not playing any notes, just waiting, waiting, waiting. And it was early in the morning, and I got a call. I think it was Winton who called me, and Winton Marsalis, and he's telling me that, wow, you know, Milt Jackson just passed away. And in that moment, after I hung up the phone, I heard a piece of music immediately, and it's one of the first times that I heard a piece of music from beginning to end within like 5 minutes. This piece is called Epilogue.
Something that you've dedicated to Milt Jackson, Epilogue, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I think we should just listen to a little bit of that, so I'll take this opportunity to say thanks for coming in. It's been a real treat having you in the studio.
Oh, thanks for having me. I hope it was interesting for the listeners out there.
I think that we can be fairly certain of that. Stefan Harris, jazz vibraphonist. We were joined earlier by Gary Giddens, jazz critic at The Village Voice. The Stefan Harris Quartet is playing tonight at 8 p.m. at the Berklee Performance Center in Boston. Details can be found at our website, theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.